You're listening to Season 2, Episode 9 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey, storytellers, before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. They're the first low residency MFA program in the country to focus exclusively on writing for young readers. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. Now, about today's show, we have New York Times bestselling children's book author Adam Rubin. He's published over half a dozen critically acclaimed picture books, including his super popular book, Dragons Love Tacos. Adam discusses how he transitioned from advertising to writing and how teaching improv classes helped to hone his skills as a writer. Listeners, I know a lot of you are working on writing your own children's books, so this episode is perfect for you. Adam generously shares writing and career advice that you'll definitely want to pay special attention to. So let's jump right in. Hey, what's up, everyone? We have Adam Rubin here with us today. Adam, what's up? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am so good. Thank you so much for coming on to the show. We're so excited to learn more about you and your work. Let's start it off with, how did you get into writing children's books?
Well, I started off after college working at a place called Leo Burnett, which is an ad agency in Chicago. And I was writing a lot of commercials and billboards and radio ads and all sorts of stuff on behalf of clients like Kellogg's and Procter & Gamble and McDonald's. And I had been there for about a year when I got an email out of the blue from a guy I had never met before named Dan Salmeri. And it turned out that Dan and I had a friend in common named Corey. I had gone through art school with Corey, and Dan had gone to LaGuardia, which is an art high school in New York City, with Corey. And Corey connected the two of us, just thinking that since Dan was an illustrator and I was a writer, we might hit it off. So I got this email from Daniel, and he sent me his portfolio of work after he was graduating from the Institute of the Arts in Philadelphia. He had these amazing images that he had created as part of his thesis presentation. Then I sent him some short stories I had written and some ads that I had made and some videos that I made in college, and we just immediately hit it off. So never having met, we decided to collaborate on a picture book. That was something that Dan wanted to do and something he had really focused on in his studies in the illustration department. So when he graduated, he was kind of shopping around in New York City, meeting with editors and things to get a picture book career going. Meanwhile, I had never thought of myself as being a picture book author. I didn't really know much about picture books, but I got to work with this guy. He is awesome. So I wrote a story that was based on my dad. When I was a kid, he used to have a lot of problems with the squirrels eating from his bird feeders. And I wrote this little story for Dan. And he was really hitting the bricks in New York City and putting his work out there as much as possible. So in one meeting, he showed this woman a copy of the manuscript and some sketches that he had done, and she bought the book. So from his perspective, he was putting the work in and really pounding the pavement. But for me, I just sent this guy a story, and the next thing I knew, we had a publishing deal.
That's amazing. Okay, so when you mentioned that you wrote a few stories, were those stories that you worked on before you met him, or you just started?
I studied writing in college, and I majored in advertising design. So I have a BFA from WashU in St. Louis, but I took every writing class that you could in English and Spanish, and just really always loved to write, but was way more focused on comedy and sketch comedy and humor. I did a lot of magazine articles and profiles of interesting inventors or sort of polymaths that I would meet. It was kind of a trick I would use to get to know interesting people better, is to write an article about them and to do a profile, which is a great way to get to know somebody. But I wrote a lot of sketch comedy in college, and also in Chicago, I was working with a theater called the Annoyance Theater. And I still work with them today. They've got an outpost now in New York. It was founded by Mick Napier, and they're a really subversive comedy theater that has been operating in Chicago, I think, for like 20 years now. And the stuff I was doing there is not good for kids. And the shows that I was writing there are definitely not appropriate for children. But Dan and I share that sort of sensibility. That more subversive streak definitely goes through both of our work. So I think that was really what drew him to me and what drew me to him as well, is that neither one of us is exclusively a children's author or a children's illustrator. In fact, I still write comedy. I still write for magazines and for adults, but primarily the more popular work is for children. Meanwhile, Dan is now doing editorial work for the New York Times and all this kind of stuff. So the advertising really taught me to write for a lot of different audiences, because depending on the product, you're trying to appeal to Midwestern housewives or high-powered business executives or whoever.
And you mentioned the Annoyance Theater, and you teach that right now in Brooklyn. You teach improv. I know you said you were writing as well, sketch comedy, but improv, that's usually coming from an actor's background. Are you teaching the acting of improv, or are you teaching like the writing of sketch?
Improv can be used to help generate ideas for writing, but generally theatrical improv, as we do it over at the Annoyance Theater, it's like long form improv. It's sort of a free form, jazzy way to make a bunch of people laugh, hopefully, in a room where it's not really like what you would see on Whose Line Is It Anyway with the bells and the games. It's a lot more amorphous and it's a lot more open ended. And so when you teach, quote unquote, teach improv, it's really more about just getting people to unleash their imagination and drop their fear and act a little more childlike and gel with the other people that they're playing with, because it really is just a spirit of play and just teaching adults to act like kids.
How do you find time to write and do all of this?
I quit my day job a year ago, so that freed up quite a bit of time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because anybody that's been a creative director in an ad agency knows that it's not exactly a 9-to-5. Sometimes you got to be in a city the next day you didn't plan on being in, or have a pitch meeting at the end of the week that you didn't know was coming. And so it often winds up being pretty time intensive and a little bit unpredictable. So leaving the day job definitely freed up a lot of time. And it was fun to start directing again and teaching at the Annoyance. Now I've kind of stepped back away from that a little more. There's a huge influx of amazingly talented people have come in from Chicago that are primarily comedians, and people that you see at the Annoyance performing now or teaching now are definitely people that you'll see on TV in a year or two, and even starting to pop up on all sorts of shows. It's really actually fun to see friends of mine now that are getting like really famous, or just kind of on these Netflix comedy specials, or on Colbert, or writing for Seth Meyers. And you get this weird sense of pride, like you didn't do anything to help them, but still you see them like, hey, that's so cool. And there's just this really powerful wave of comedians that are taking the whole comedy world by storm from Chicago when I was coming up, and they're all just amazingly friendly people, really collaborative people, and you see them reaching out to each other. When one of them gets a shot to get a Netflix special, they'll have a bunch of other friends of theirs appear in the special or pop up on some show that they're writing for. So that it's pretty cool to see that community from the other side.
Were you ever inspired for a character for one of your children's books from your improv community? My really close best friend, he's always doing improv. He's doing improv shows, troupes, classes, and he's always coming up with all these amazing ideas for characters. Does that ever happen for you?
For me, when improv's going really well, I really have a lot of trouble remembering what happened afterwards. So that's kind of a tricky part of it. But also the best improv is so specific to that moment that it's really hard to translate into something else.
Yeah, or recreate.
It's really hard to recreate. One of the things they do at the Annoyance is using improv to develop theatrical shows like musicals or theatrical narrative shows. And they're always a little bonkers and kind of have that spirit of play, but you get better at using the muscle of doing something again, but a little bit different, and then trying it again, but a little bit different. And that probably has helped me more in the writing than any specific character or specific situation that's come up in an improv scene.
You're almost like you're writing workshop classes.
Yeah.
Indirectly. I want to know more about your books as well. What inspired you to create RoboSauce?
For me, I almost always start with the title first. I don't know why that is. The title usually comes to me first, and I got a whole list of titles that don't have stories, and I got a whole list of titles that have two or three stories that are totally different attached to them. So RoboSauce was the first phrase that came into my mind. I wanted to do something with robots. Wasn't sure exactly what it would be. And it kind of turned into this crazy story about a kid making this magic potion and then taking over the book and the book turning into a robot. And that evolved slowly working with the editor, because when I first showed her the story, and just for the listeners that don't know the book RoboSauce, it's a story about a kid He loves robots. He wants to be a robot. So the narrator teaches him how to make this magic potion called RoboSauce that will turn him into a giant, awesome robot. So he does, and he kind of goes on a rampage and destroys the town. And the narrator tries to teach him a lesson, say, look, maybe you'd be better off if you went back to being a human. You miss your parents and your friends, but instead the kid just goes and turns everybody else into robots, turns the whole town into robots, and the robots take over the book, and the book itself turns into a robot. So when I originally showed my editor the manuscript, the ending of the book was a little more traditional. The kid did learn the lesson that he maybe is better off being a human, and then the surprise ending was that the dog accidentally licked up some of the spilt sauce, some of the leftover sauce on the floor, and the dog turned into a robot. And when I showed it to my editor, she was kind of like, maybe it could just take a little bit of a turn. And so I think I probably took that to an extreme. Instead said, all right, well, the dog will turn into a robot, the parents will turn into a robot, the friends, the town, the food, the narrator will turn into a robot, and then the whole book will turn into a robot. She was just kind of like, okay, whatever you say, Adam. But we did figure out a way to turn the book into a robot. I made this little prototype, and it folds out, and this long page sort of wraps around the book and turns into a second dust jacket and turns the book upside down. So the story starts over again in a robot version of the story.
That's awesome. For your main characters, I know that you said you start with the titles and then you figure out the story from there. But then how about the characters? How do you dive into the main characters?
I think more than anything, they're just representatives of the reader a lot of the time. At least
Gotcha.
in RoboSauce and in Dragons Love Tacos, the kid basically, I think, represents my more childish instincts and how I would respond in this sort of situation. And a lot of times in the stories recently, it's kind of the adult version of me versus the kid version of me, whereas the adult is the narrator and the kid is the character, this odd conspiratorial moment. So I would say it's probably more bizarre reflections of myself. When we did Those Darn Squirrels, we got an award, we got to meet Whoopi Goldberg, we got all these nice reviews, and so we got to do a couple more books. That's really what got us into it. I mean, we could have done that one book just randomly, and it would have been this weird, fun thing that I did with this guy, Dan, and never thought about it again. But it was really well received, and so that built up a lot of momentum. And in that story, the squirrels are kind of these fuzzy little geniuses, and the old man is this grumpy grouch of a guy. And I think that's probably the more specific characters. The more memorable character, I think, of all the stories is Old Man Fuquire, the old man in the squirrels books. People write to me about him the most. Nobody's like, hey, I love that red dragon in those in Dragons Love Tacos. I really relate to the red dragon. They're kind of they're not the most deep and fleshed out
I relate to
characters.
the red dragon because I got sunburnt the other day,
Yeah,
so.
maybe. Well, kids do relate to the dragon sometimes because they love tacos or they hate spicy salsa or they like
Yeah,
parties
it's
or
so
whatever that
cute.
is.
I've spoken with a few children's book authors, and a lot of times they don't have any say in what is illustrated at all. They pass it on and then an illustrator is found for them. So this sounds like it's a really special this collaborative team that you have. Do you have a lot of say in how, like talking about characters now, like how they are, what they look like? Do you have a lot of say in how they look like? If like Daniel draws something specific, do you go in and say like, "Hey, really like that, but could you I was thinking maybe more of this?" Like or no, like you totally respect his process. You don't touch that aspect at all or influence it at all.
Well, it's a balance. I mean, Dan and I have a lot of respect for one another's expertise. And I think when you're collaborating to make a successful work, you have to have respect for the other person's talent, but you also have to share a sensibility. And so for us, we talk throughout the process. I talk to Dan even before I start writing the manuscript, just about the basic idea I have for the book. And he'll tell me what he thinks and give me feedback. And then even I'll send him drafts before I send them to the editor. And the same in the illustration process. He'll send me sketches or kind of talk through things, or we'll be having dinner or drinks and he'll sketch something on a napkin and say, what do you think of this? But I think the key to our collaboration is that at some point, both of us go off into our respective corners and finish the work. And each of us knows that the other one is going to make it turn out better than we could have expected. So that's really been one of the best parts of our collaboration, is that as much as we talk and are on the same page, when I go off from a mid-draft to the final manuscript and bring it to him, he's always surprised and happy about how things changed and evolved. And the same when he goes from sketches or from thumbnails to finished sketches and I get to see the whole book laid out, it's so exciting because there's so many things that he brings to life that I never could have pictured in my imagination. I just don't understand how, I don't want to get in a soapbox here, but it seems crazy to me that the standard formula is let's have somebody write the book and then with zero input or collaboration, have somebody completely different illustrate the book. That seems nuts to me. The only explanation is that the publishing house just wants to have more influence and power over the process because it just doesn't make any sense. Like, no other creative field works that way.
It's true, because also like with authors, and this is what I learned from a very, very recent interview, was that when authors write books, they have some say in the cover, but then what I was told was that the team ends up really deciding.
I think if what's selling the book is the person who wrote it, then they probably get more input. If it's a first-time author and they're just like, well, we think zombie stories about World War II are hot right now, then they're probably like, okay, give us the manuscript and then shut up and take your check.
It's really fascinating how writing an entire children's book, it could be totally out of your hands and it could morph into a different story because someone with a totally different style or vision comes in and then creates this book. It has to work hand in hand. It's like 50-50.
There's a lot of good reasons to not let an author dictate what the illustration should be. There's a lot of great, I mean, they're not illustrators. They're not picture people, right? There's word people and there's picture people. Every so often you get somebody that has experience with both. And for me, being a creative director, having an art degree in design and having collaborated with illustrators, designers, art directors, developers throughout my 10-year career in advertising, it would drive me completely insane to see something fully realized without any sort of input. That would just drive me nuts. Now, that's not to say that I want to dictate what is drawn or, and I've collaborated with other illustrators since Dan, where it's a discussion. And if you can be a good collaborator and you can suggest, make suggestions or put your ideas out there, but then have the humility to understand that if the other contributor or collaborator doesn't agree, or if they have an idea they like better or they want to change it, then you have to be okay with that. And I can see where it becomes dangerous if you get an author that has this really singular vision and they just are completely.
They're like completely rigid.
Exactly. And that could be a problem. So I could see where you could run into issues where somebody's saying, no, that's the wrong color, or that this needs to be bigger, or they would never dress like that. And that could be problematic and cause friction. So maybe that's part of the reason that the publishing industry has set it up the way that they have, because maybe it's just more trouble than it's worth. But for me, I wouldn't even enter into a project if I didn't think that it was going to be collaborative. I'm working with this amazing guy right now named Crash McCreary.
How did you meet him?
My agent, Jen, set it up. It turns out it's good to have a literary agent. I didn't have one for the first four books,
What?
which was kind of a perfect situation because then I had Drags of Tacos became a New York Times bestseller. That was our fifth book, I think. Was it our fifth
Congratulations,
book?
by the way.
Yeah, thank you. It was actually our fourth book. It was our fourth book. The original publisher didn't want to publish it, so we went to Penguin and they published it, and then it was a bestseller.
Wow, I
So
love that. You're like, so we just went to Penguin, no big deal.
Well, no, Dan had an agent at that point named Rebecca Sherman, and she brought it to Penguin. So it was absolutely Rebecca Sherman that brought us to Penguin. And so she had seen Dan do four books previously, so it wasn't like she really had to take a leap of faith, and even less so for my agent. I love my agent; she's amazing. But I had a New York Times bestselling book by the time I got an agent. So, when I was talking to people about representing me, it was nice to be able to say, "Well, look, I've done this already," and kind of approach it from that perspective rather than begging and pleading somebody to be my agent, which was lucky and pretty unusual from what I hear.
A lot of people have to pitch, get query letters, and all that stuff. So,
Yeah, I mean, it seems like I even feel bad talking about it sometimes because I'll meet people that are just really striving to break into the industry. And I feel like I slipped in a field of four-leaf clovers. You know, I found a lucky penny or whatever under the rainbow, and it couldn't have worked out better. I feel super lucky
it's like almost like hearing actors who are discovered in a restaurant,
about it.
and it's whoa, he was so good looking. We're gonna cast him in a big time movie. But the thing is, you still have to have the chops to prove that you can stay. And you've had what, seven published books? Yeah, so it's like an opportunity was presented to you. You took it, you ran with it, and you're killing it. So everybody has different paths. It's inspiring to hear things like this too. I think it's awesome.
I think it's awesome too.
So you're happy with the literary agent. So you're saying that you actually realize, like, wow, it does make a big difference.
It does make a big difference because it just makes you seem more legit. You don't have to be the bad guy sometimes when things don't go how you'd like. Jen introduced me to this guy named Crash McCreary because he's also represented by ICM. And Crash is a guy that's been in the production world in movies for many, many years. And there's some great videos about him and his creative process on YouTube. But he's the guy who works behind the scenes for the most part. So he worked in Stan Winston's Creature Shop and did a lot of the production design for Jurassic Park, Terminator 2. He designed Davy Jones in the Pirates of the Caribbean, like the guy with the octopus beard and the crab leg. And he did all the character design for Rango with Johnny Depp. So he has
the one with that little lizard.
Yeah, with the lizard.
Oh,
yeah.
That's so cute.
Yeah, yeah. So we're working together now on a book called Chupacabra.
Oh my gosh.
Which
that
is
awesome.
Hopefully going to be out in 2017. And it's about the Chupacabra legend, which if you're from the Southwest or the West Coast, you probably know about. But it's basically a Latin American Bigfoot type of creature that's kind of vampire-like and sneaks off into the night and eats goats. So we've done a children's story version of this, and it's bilingual. It's written in both Spanish and English simultaneously. So
are you taking care of the Spanish part too?
Yeah, I am not a native speaker. My grandmother's Cuban, so I speak Spanish all right. I'm certainly not teaching any graduate level courses in Spanish. You know, every so often somebody will say something I don't know. I don't know that word. Really, the hardest part about Spanish is, well, there's two hard parts. The first is that the words change from country to country. Even if the countries are right next to each other, they might have a word. Rato and ratito mean a short time and a long time, but they mean the opposite thing in different countries. So that's just one sort of tricky example of how words change. But the hardest part about Spanish that we take for granted in English is there's 50 different conjugations. And I'm not exaggerating. There's 50 different conjugations for each verb, depending on the time, the subject, the condition, subjunctive, whether it definitely happened or might happen, all these sort of things. So as an English speaker, that's the trickiest part.
When you're writing this and it's bilingual, are you struggling? Do you kind of pull up Google Translate or do you call your family for help?
Well, in this case, I kept the language really, really simple. Things don't always translate directly.
Yeah.
From English to Spanish or in any language. But I tried in most cases in the book to keep it as direct translation as possible, keep the sentence structure really, really simple. So when you read the book, everything is written in couplets. So, for example, it might say, this all happened a long time ago en una granja de cabras in Mexico. So the next line would say, todo esto ocurrió hasta mucho tiempo on a goat farm in Mexico. So all the lines are kind of mirror images of each other, whether the first part is Spanish and the next part is English or vice versa.
I see. And then the illustrations, of course, would almost sort of match that?
The illustrations are all in Spanish.
Illustrations are in Spanish? What do you mean by that? Wait, what?
Yeah, I'm just kidding. I was like, yeah, in some cases, the idea is that you could speak only English or only Spanish and read the whole book and understand everything completely. For kids, a lot of times when they read picture books, they may not speak either one. So definitely the pictures do a lot of communicating too.
Whoa, Chupacabra. I'm really, really excited about that. So hopefully it does come out in 2017. So that process has been amazing so far with this new illustrator?
I think I had a huge advantage because as a creative director in an ad agency, you have to collaborate with so many different people, whether it's in your agency or with contractors or with production houses or directors or whoever. And so you learn to really to kind of check your ego at the door and realize that there are so many people that are better at so many things than you. And the best thing you can do is just let them do their thing that they're good at and make you look good when you're working with them. So Crash he's way more figurative than Dan is in his illustration style, which is really exciting to see a book that I've written illustrated in such a different style. And his approach is so painterly, and the way he generates images is amazing. I mean, the guy is just so talented. It's almost like magic to watch him draw or to watch him just see his mind work. But he's this kind of laid-back surfer dude from California, and he's got this like deep smoker's laugh, and it's been great working with Crash.
for our audience, the listeners, a lot of them are beginner storytellers. A lot of them do want to write children's books too. Is there any advice that you can pass on to them so that when they're kind of embarking on this journey as a storyteller, that it might be a little smoother for their path?
Yeah, for sure. I would say just focus on the words. Don't worry too much about what illustrator you're going to get, what agent you're going to get, what editor you're going to get, and just write a story that you like, because you never know, A, who's going to read it, and B, if they're going to like it or not. I mean, people have a million different opinions and a million different sensibilities. So if you write something you like, at least you know you'll have one fan.
True.
And that's really been my approach throughout my career. It's just, you don't know what other people are going to like. So if you like it, you got to just trust your own sensibility and hope that other people share that same opinion, because otherwise it feels like pandering. And you'll read books sometimes where you're just thinking, who the hell are they writing this for? Like, do they think they talk down to kids, or they talk up to parents, or they just, it seems like this weird corporate gobbledygook that was concocted in a focus group. And I think you can tell when somebody has a unique voice and they are just trying to write something personal.
I'm assuming you're not a dad.
I'm not a dad.
Do you have siblings? Did you grow up with younger siblings that you helped to take care of?
Nope. I know very little about children. I don't have a lot of experience with children. I don't spend a lot of time with children.
I find that super interesting and fascinating, because the children's book authors that I've spoken to, most of them have had children or have grown up with a lot of kids around them, or their older siblings, you know? So how do you connect with them in a respectful manner?
Well, I think the way that I relate to children is just that I have the mind of a child, and that I never kind of grew out of that mindset. So that's sort of how I approach the world, is through this lens of curiosity and joy. And that's kind of how kids experience the world too. So I don't feel any need to talk down to them or to change the way I would talk to an adult. I mean, I don't use curse words. I don't talk about concepts they don't necessarily understand. But I mean, sometimes I do. There's jokes about rents being high in the books. There's jokes about, you know, the whole RoboSauce book is about the singularity and robots taking over the world. So the thing that's funny about picture books is that it's not just for kids. The books are read to kids, but the books are read by parents and aunts and librarians and teachers and babysitters and older siblings. And so you've got a million different kinds of people reading these books. And if you are boiling everything down and making it so dumb simple that it's just for a three-year-old to understand, it's going to make a parent insane to read this book 100 times. So if you look at the guys whose books we're reading 50 years later, most of them didn't have kids. You know, Seuss didn't have kids, I don't believe. And Sendak definitely didn't have kids. In fact, he hated kids. He never even considered his books children's books. He just said, I make these books, these picture books, and you say they're for kids. So the idea that you've got to put on gloves and kneel down and raise your voice and patronize these smaller humans, it's that, I mean, they're a lot smarter than people give them credit for. Some of them aren't. I mean, I've met some pretty dim children, but that's just, there's stupid adults too. So I always think that you kind of shoot, even when I teach, and I've taught kids different classes. I'm one of the people that's guilty to teaching to the smartest kids in the room and hoping that everybody absorbs whatever they can. And maybe that's a bad approach, but it seems to have worked so far.
I do love asking my guests if there's ever events or experiences that have changed their life or their perspective in like a cool, positive way.
I think one of my favorite places to be contemplative or self-reflective is in the woods. I like the mountains. I like to get into nature and really get away from other people or other kind of man-made stuff and just get back to the really simple idea that all you got to do is make sure you have enough food, that you're warm enough, that you have some water. So hiking has been, and camping is a thing I would suggest. It's not for everybody. I don't know. I feel like those revelatory moments are so personal. I think another thing that really changed my perspective is when I was living in Chicago, I was volunteering at a soup kitchen in my neighborhood, and I was living in Uptown at the time, which is north of the city. Not very far. It's still in the city limits, but it's kind of a very diverse neighborhood. There's a men's shelter. There's a Buddhist temple. There's a Jamaican restaurant. I mean, it's just a really, really a mix of people, which is pretty unusual in Chicago, which is a fairly self-segregated city. But I would see these guys come in, that I would see them on the street sometimes, and then they would come in the morning, and I'm making them eggs to order and stuff. And you realize that you got it pretty good sometimes. You take things for granted, and you just next door is somebody that's really struggling. So I think it's easy to get complacent and get down on yourself or worry about things that maybe are smaller problems than they seem.
Talking about that, how do you define a meaningful job? What is a job to you that matters? And I know, like, this obviously anyone can have any answer, but curious about your perspective.
If you do something you're passionate about, then that's meaningful to you.
Simple but true. Love it. Okay, so let's wrap it up with one more question. Recommended books for us to check out. What have you read that has inspired you?
Okay. Well, I'll give you my children's books that I love. The ones that I always come back to, some of them from when I was a kid, some of them from as an adult, but Strega Nona, I always love, by Tommy DiPaolo. Which is the magic pot with that makes the spaghetti, all the spaghetti. I love The Three Robbers by Tommy Ungerer, and they just reissued it. Faden just reissued it a couple years ago, so it's a lot easier to find now. That's a beautiful book. And Tommy Ungerer, if you're not familiar, is a guy worth checking out. There's a documentary that I think it's still on Netflix called Far Out Isn't Far Enough. And he is just a singular personality. I mean, that guy is awesome. He made picture books. He made anti-war posters. Did huge advertising campaigns for the Village Voice and for all sorts of different big companies back in the 60s and 70s. And his illustration style influenced all these different people with just amazingly expressive line quality. He also had these odd sexual predilections and made a lot of pornographic illustration books as well, which didn't sit well with school librarians at the time, and a lot of his books wound up being banned. But he's a highly acclaimed children's author, and I think that they've forgiven him for that. And now that, or some people, the less Puritan, more progressive people have decided that it's okay that you can make art for two different audiences. So that's part of what the movie is about. How can an artist be accepted as two different things, or three different things, or four different things? Another one that was hugely influential for me was called The Stinky Cheese Man by John Sheska and illustrated by Lane Smith. So it's totally hilarious, and it's subversive, and it plays with the form, and it feels conspiratorial, which is definitely something that I find pops up in my own work subconsciously. That book definitely had a big influence on the tone of the things that I write. And another book that I'll just recommend to anybody that first sort of understanding of human behavior or psychology is Thinking Fast and Slow, which is a book by Daniel Kahneman. And it's, there's a lot of pop psych books that people have written, but this is the guy that actually did the research. He's in his 80s now. He invented behavioral, well, he didn't invent, but he kind of was one of the early contributors and influential researchers that established the field of behavioral economics. So he's a really smart and
He's a
innovative
badass,
scientist. Yeah,
basically.
he's definitely a badass, and his book is re revelatory in a lot of ways.
Adam, you've been amazing, and I'm really excited about the Chupacabra that you have with
Me
Crash.
too.
We'll look forward to that. Also, we'll check that out. Definitely, listeners, check out all his other books. He's published seven. He's so cool. Adam, have an amazing day, and thank you again.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Hey guys, that wraps up our chat with Adam Rubin. I hope you had fun with this episode and learned lots from Adam's journey and the tips he shared. Thank you for listening in as always, and a huge thank you to Adam for joining us today. For a list of all the books and resources in today's episode, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/AdamRubin. And I'm excited to share a bit about our sponsor for today's episode. Like I mentioned earlier, I know there's a lot of you who are really interested in writing books for children or young adults. So you'll definitely want to pay special attention to what Vermont College of Fine Arts has to offer. VCFA has three different graduate level programs for writers, and I'll be going into detail about their program called Writing for Children and Young Adults. Students meet up twice a year on their gorgeous campus in the heart of historic Montpelier in Vermont for intensive 10-day residencies. It's a lot like 10-day retreats for writers, and you guys know how much I love retreats. Imagine attending VCFA's MFA program where you'll be immersed in an amazing writing community filled with intensive workshops, lectures, panel discussions, and readings that are always challenging and inspiring you. After the life-changing experiences at the residencies, you and the faculty will design your own course for the start of the semester by really zoning in on your specific writing goals. Throughout the semester, you'll continue working with faculty mentors through telephone conferences, emails, and letters. So basically, you're receiving one-on-one mentorship throughout your semester as you take control in shaping the kind of education you want out of your time with VCFA. Check out 88cupsoftea.com/go/VCFA for more info. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.